Welcome to the November Narrators Podcast. The theme for this show is food, and I had some audio difficulties when I recorded this. There's some mysterious static that comes and goes throughout the podcast, and unfortunately I had to cut some of the stories just due to the static. They were great stories, but there was just too much of the weird static interference. So I tried my best to clean them up. The static does come and go, but the stories that I chose, these have the best audio quality. So if there's some annoying static, just be patient. It should go away. It just sort of pops up at odd times. But I apologize for that. And without any more excuses on my part, let's get into the show.
The very first job I ever had, I worked at a barbecue restaurant here in Colorado called County Line Barbecue. I don't know if it still exists. It's down in the suburbs. It was my very first job. I was a dishwasher, and they, like, produced the meat there. They had, like, a butcher who would, like, chop up the meat and, like, you know, arrange it and everything. I thought it was the coolest job I'd ever had because it was my first job. So even though I was a dishwasher at a barbecue restaurant and it was, like, the most disgusting job, I was like, yeah, I'm finally moving up in the world. And I'd go home at the end of the day just reeking of barbecue and, like, barbecue smoke, and it would just be ingrained in my clothes. But one day, and I loved it. I loved eating there. It was just so great. One day, the guy who butchered the ribs liked to chew tobacco. He would like to always have like a big mouthful of tobacco. Apparently, this wasn't that long ago, but apparently health laws weren't in effect when this happened 20 years ago. So he's always had a big mouthful of tobacco. And one day, he was bringing this giant pan full of ribs that he'd arranged and he'd chopped, and he was carrying them by me, and tobacco juice was dribbling out of his mouth, speckling all of these barbecued ribs with tobacco juice out of his mouth. And I saw this, he's walking by me, and I was like, oh my God. And he looked at me and he just like laughs, and that was like what made it so much grosser than it already was, as this guy like, yeah, look what I'm doing. Like, this is so disgusting. And like, they're not going to wash that meat. They just probably dunk it in barbecue sauce. And they're like, yeah, it's a little extra spicy because it has somebody's tobacco spit on it. It was so disgusting. So don't eat at County Line Barbecue is my first story. My next story, when I was about 8 years old, give or take, we went down to Santa Fe, New Mexico to visit my grandma. And my grandma's favorite restaurant, just like your grandma's favorite restaurant, is Furs Cafeteria. I don't even know if Furs Cafeteria is still in existence. There probably is one or two somewhere in some right by a retirement home. They're disgusting. This is a gross story just because it takes place at Furs Cafeteria. Even if I didn't tell you the rest of the story, it's gross because it's Furs Cafeteria and it tastes like a cafeteria where old people would love to eat. So I go there with my grandma and I get like a bowl of macaroni and cheese, and I get a little side of vegetables. And so I'm eating my macaroni and cheese, and I come across a hair in my macaroni and cheese, like a black, curly hair. And it's gross, and I'm like, I'm not going to eat this anymore. So I push my macaroni and cheese away, and I just like eat my vegetables, and I finish my vegetables. And then I'm bored, and I'm just sitting at a table. So I start poking through my macaroni and cheese with a fork, and I come to the bottom, and there is a nest of these black pubes in the bottom of this bowl of macaroni and cheese. Yeah, and I mean a nest. And I say pubes because they're black curly hairs, and I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Because I was like, maybe it's like an afro, like somebody like buzzed their afro over the macaroni and cheese. No, that's definitely, I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico. No one was buzzing their afro. And even if they were, that's still really disgusting. Oh, it was so gross. And so I see that. And I I'm like, look at this. I'm like showing everybody like, ah, look at all his hair in the bottom of his cup. And everybody's like, ew. And my grandma was so angry at me. She's like, well, now you ruined dinner for everybody. She was so angry. And I felt so bad for so long. And then when I was remembering the story, I was like, why did I feel bad at all? Like, as an adult, if that happened, I would have jumped up on the table and be like, everyone eating in here, stop eating. I want you to know what I just found in this bowl of macaroni and cheese. Because it's so disgusting. Why would I keep that a secret And then maybe after the meal, when we're all in the car on the way home, be like, oh, I forgot to mention to you guys, there was a giant hairball of disgusting black hair in my food. I don't know how yours was. Apparently that's what she thought I would do. So don't eat at first cafeteria is the motto of my second story. Thank you. So those are my stories right up front. We have a bunch of great storytellers. Your next storyteller has been on the show many times. He's one of the best comedians I probably know. He made his national television debut recently on the ABC sitcom Happy Endings. Please welcome Adam Caton Holland.
When I was 22 years old, right after I graduated from college, I moved with two friends to Spain in this small town called Santiago de Compostela. It's right above Portugal. Very cool town, college town. And my two friends and I got an apartment there, but we were 22. We didn't know what we were doing. We saw an apartment that we thought looked cool, had a sign for rent. We inquired at a restaurant around the corner, and they're like, $300 a month? We're like, okay, fine. Furnished with nothing. No sheets, no plates, fucking nothing. But we're like, that's okay. You don't need things to live. We didn't know what we were doing. So we got the apartment, and we had absolutely nothing in there. But fortunately, we had some neighbors who were med students at the university in town and also cokeheads. And the thing about cokeheads is they're very gregarious. So they were knocking on our door all the time. They helped us out. They gave us plates and sheets, and they taught us how to live like Spaniards. And it was great. But this was also, and they became our friends and sort of our family, our surrogate family over there. This was also right at the time that America was gearing up for war with Iraq. So there was a ton of anti-American sentiment everywhere. Like that, every night we went out, people say, where are you from? We'd say, America. They'd be like, fuck you, you know, warmonger. And then we'd have to be like, hey, I don't really like Bush either. And then you could hopefully have some sort of conversation. But normally it just degraded from that to them yelling at you. So we were feeling, it was this odd feeling of like having to vouch for your country while simultaneously rejecting what your country was doing. So we kind of had to defend, you had this like American patriotism, but with a grain of salt. So we were always like, you know, representatives of America. So by the time Thanksgiving rolled around, we really wanted to show our friends some of the positive side of like things that Americans do. So we decided we would have a huge Thanksgiving, a big feast. We'd cook everything up. We'd invite all our Spanish friends, and it would be a great American thing for us to show them. But we also had an ulterior motive, which was to make our friend Ricardo puke. Ricardo was the worst of the bunch. Like, every night we would go out, Ricardo would start talking shit about Americans, about George Bush, and be like, hey, Ricardo, you know who's second line behind George Bush in going to Iraq? Aznar, the president of fucking Spain. And he'd be like, yeah, whatever, I'm a separatist. And be like, all right, you're not even playing the rules, buddy. So we decided we're going to make Ricardo puke because he would always just condescend to us. He'd, like, make fun of our Spanish. And we'd be like, listen, vosotros is hard. We never learned that growing up. Mexicans speak Spanish where we're from. And he's like, Mexicans didn't start this language. Spaniards did. And we're like, all right, fucking Ricardo. And try to recover from the night. But one thing Ricardo really came down on us for was our tendency to get so drunk that we'd vomit. We were 22. Sometimes we would drink to excess. But for Ricardo, it wasn't a thing of disgust. He wasn't like, ugh, how could you drink to the point where you vomit? He'd be like, men should not vomit from drinking. He's like, you guys are pussies. That's why you vomit when you drink. I've never vomited once from drinking. You Americans don't know how to drink. And we're like, all right, Ricardo, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. So we prepared this mammoth feast. We had all our Spanish friends over. We stuffed them full of food. We didn't even have an oven in our apartment. We convinced a restaurant to lend us their oven so we could make a turkey. We did it up proper. And then after that, everybody was pretty stuffed. And we're like, hey, have you guys ever heard of a game called Beer Pong, Spanish friends? And they hadn't. But we were prepared. We had bought wiffle balls. We had bought keg cups. And so we set up Beer Pong, and we started playing. And of course, we got Ricardo into the mix. And I remember it vividly. It was me and a friend, Ricardo, and his little sister. And so we're playing them. And our one rule that was just perfectly cruel was that if we make two in a row and get the balls back, not only do we get the balls back, you have to take a shot of absinthe from a bottle that we had. So, like, we've been training for this moment our whole college careers. First two shots, boom, boom, sink them, they come back. Ricardo, absinthe, have it. he puked all of Spain, like fucking Picasso paintings, parts of Hemingway's beard, like he just exploded every, it was like the meal in reverse all across the Beirut table. And we just didn't care. We thought it was the funniest thing we'd ever seen in our life. His sister started cleaning it up, apologizing. No, leave it. It's fine. We want to celebrate the fact that Ricardo puked like a pussy. And I kind of realized how important food was in bringing us all together in that moment, because food can show you the good side of our country. What we do, we gather and we feast around food. But food can also show you the bad side of our country, which is we just like to go abroad sometimes and wreak fucking havoc. And so Ricardo's little sister cleaned it off, and Ricardo left with his kind of head in his hands, ashamed. He was actually crying. It was hilarious. And then our cokehead neighbors realized that something else was going on. They're like, "Oh, you guys having a party?" And we're like, "Yeah, but it stinks like shit in here because of Ricardo, the pussy." They're like, "Do you want to come over to our house? We have a 8-ball." And we're like, "Yes, we do." And we partied on and on until 7 in the morning. And for that night and that night only, America and Spain got along famously. Thanks, everybody.
Adam Caton Holland. I'm so naive and drug virginal that when you said 8-ball, my first thing my brain thought of was a magic 8-ball, like a party game. I was like, "Oh, that sounds cool. I do that." And then I did all the math, and I was like, "Oh, they're cokeheads. Okay, different 8-ball." Adam wanted me to plug, if you're in the Seattle area tomorrow night, Adam will be performing. Where was it again? Jewel Box Theater. If you're in Seattle tomorrow, or if you just want to go tomorrow, Adam's at the Jewel Box Theater in Seattle. So I plugged it for you, Adam. There you go. You got the word out. Your next storyteller, she's been on the show a few times. She actually had her story picked up by the Risk podcast, which is a nationwide podcast that has sort of partnered up with this show to choose stories that they really love to play on their show. And she's the only one who's had a story chosen to be performed on that show. She was an animator in Asia for quite a while. This is Jan Scott Fraser.
Hey, everybody. I lived in Asia for 14 years, which brought me to some food experiences that some were kind of creepy, some were really disgusting, and some were absolutely horrifying. So let's talk about that. When I lived in Thailand for a number of years. I had my own animation studio there. And one thing I've noticed that not only in Thailand, but in a lot of places, most especially China, people like to take the foreigner and go, "Ooh, here's our weird food. Let's see if you like this." In Thailand, it was locusts. A guy came by the studio, and he had a pole over his shoulder, and he had these two baskets hanging, and they were full of locusts. And I thought, "Ew, is he going to take them to the trash or something?" And my staff is like, no, come here. And they bought this handful of locusts, and they brought them to me, and they said, "Here, eat these locusts." And I thought, well, you know, okay. So I ate a couple of the locusts, and they were basically just crunchy. It was not really that big of a deal. And they're like, "Ooh, you ate locusts." I'm like, "So what?" So then I went to China. It was in the late 90s. And I went to Beijing, and I was with I was working with this animation studio, and they were used to Japanese people coming there, and the Japanese are really easy to gross out. Very easy. You know, anything, bugs, spiders, anything like that, the Japanese will be, "Ew," especially the women. So they thought, "Let's get this one." So they ordered all this weird stuff that was weird to them, like deer. I'm like, "Venison, so what? I live in the mountains, so what?" I was not, however, used to camel. That was very interesting. It was not particularly good, but it was camel. I was not expecting the fried scorpions at all. However, fried scorpions, obviously, they remove the stinger. And fried scorpions have the texture and somewhat the taste of really fatty, overcooked bacon. So they kind of had a crunchy, chewy kind of experience. And I was like, oh, it wasn't really that bad because I was really hungry. So I started eating these scorpions. And they thought, you like these? I'm like, yeah. So they ordered another huge plate of scorpions. So I sat there eating camel and scorpions all night. In Japan, the only really weird thing I experienced there was fugu, which is the blowfish. That wasn't particularly disgusting. It made my gums tingle a little bit. Not that big a deal. However, I went with the same people who took me to fugu in Japan. We went to Korea, South Korea, and they said, okay, if you thought that was good, try this. And the Japanese call it mada ikiteru taco, which in loosely translated means still living baby octopus. The Koreans call it sannakji, I believe it is. And what they do is they have a tank, a fish tank, and they have these little octopi, or octopuses, actually is the correct word for that, these little octopuses in there, and they grab one out of there, well, you choose one, but they grab one out and they throw it in this hot water, and then they take it out of the hot water and they chop it up real fast with a big butcher knife, and they throw it on your table with some oil and some soy sauce, and it's still moving. It's still kind of twisting around, the little tentacles are going, and... I'm not a big fan of such things. Well, to actually put it in a more clear way, I was then a 310-pound, 1,600 triglyceride, eat-anything person. Now I'm a 178-pound, locavore vegetarian with my 137 triglycerides. So that was very different than I am now. So anyway... I looked at this octopus, and it's gray and moving on the plate and leaving little smears on there as it's moving. And they said, okay, when you eat this, you have to first dip it in the oil and then dip it in the soy sauce. Because if you don't dip it in the oil, the suckers will stick on the inside of your throat, and a couple people die from this every year. I was like, really? When the food chokes you, I think there's a problem there. So they had it, and I was like, okay, I'll try a couple pieces. So I picked it up with my chopsticks as it squirmed and dipped it in the oil, lots of oil, and then the soy sauce, and I ate it. And if y'all remember those little erasers that were half white and half pink, right? The white was for, like, typewriters or whatever. It tasted and smelled exactly like the white erasers. And I'm like, they said, what do you think? I said, it tastes and smells like erasers. And they're like, what? You know, so... Yeah, that was, those are kind of the gross ones. When I went to Vietnam the first time, I speak very little Vietnamese, and then I spoke none. So they would just give me food. Here, eat this. Here, this is mystery meat. Here, this is pho. This is whatever. And I couldn't even pronounce it. So one time we were eating this meat on rice and with a bunch of vegetables, and... They said, do you know what this is? I said, no, because you won't tell me. And they said, that's dog. I'm like, oh. I grew up with dogs. So when I looked at this meat, my brain immediately transferred this to golden retriever. You know, and not these gross dogs that live on the street that they actually, and the dogs that they actually breed to eat. No, I was thinking of Buck the golden retriever I had in middle school. And it was really repellent to me, and so I just pushed it away. And years later, of course, when I would read, I learned that we have learned scientifically that pigs are way smarter than dogs, almost as smart as dolphins. I still felt bad about eating the dog, but I really felt bad about eating pigs. So then we crossed the line into totally disgusting. I was in Shanghai. I've been to China a lot, as you can tell. I was in Shanghai one time, and they said, here's this delicacy that you're going to love, which I always knew would be really disgusting. So they brought out this weird, I don't really know how to describe it. It looked familiar, but I couldn't tell what it was. And I said, before I eat this, you got to tell me what this is. And they wouldn't, so I asked the service staff, and they told me, and I looked it up in the dictionary, and it was bear paw. Like they cut the paw off a bear and grill it. And, yeah, I know. And the thought of it was really revolting. So I would not touch the bear paw. Bear claws, on the other hand, those I will eat with cream in them. I'm still good with that. Bear paw, not so much. After bear paw, the Philippines. I went and I taught there a number of times, taught animation at this studio, and they have this dish called balut. And balut is basically, it's the fertilized embryo of a duck. And the best way to describe this, a friend of mine who is an animator from Canada who was there, he described it as rotten baby duck. And it really is, because it just smells disgusting. And he got a girlfriend, a Filipina girlfriend, and he went to her parents' house. They had a big holiday, and they had balut. And they put it in front of him, and they all looked at him and smiled. Well, he had heard of it, but he had never seen it before, have no idea how to eat it. How do you eat a rotten baby duck? Do you pick it up, stuff it in your mouth? What do you do? Right? So he had no idea, so he looked at it, and he looked at them, and they were all looking at him with great anticipation. And he looked at them, and he started picking it up, and he's like, he could feel the bones are super soft, so you can just eat it that way. I know that's disgusting, but that's the way it is. He started to pick it up, and being an animator and being a Canadian, he started kicking the little legs and lifting the little wings, going, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Hello, my ragtanga." Which was not, her parents were not very impressed with this. She, however, fell on the ground laughing because she thought it was so funny. He thought that he would be banned from the Philippines forever, and he probably should have been. The most disgusting thing I ever saw put on a table was I was in central China. I was helping an animation studio set up this big, basically an animation factory there. I was helping them with their computers and training their staff. And they took me to what was supposed to be the classiest restaurant in the city. And they had all sorts of, you know, interesting food. I couldn't read the menu. It was all in Chinese. Some of it I could read, but, you know, again, deer, duck, that kind of stuff. And they have this dish that they brought out, and it's called the Three Squeaks. Zombie, right? The Three Squeaks is, here we go, you have a rat which has just given birth. We know where this is going. A rat which has just given birth, and they take those little babies, the hairless, not yet eye-open babies, and they wash them in really, really, really hot water. And then they hit them in ice or cold water really quick, and then they put them on a plate so they're kind of still moving a little bit. And what you do, they call them the Three Squeaks because when you pick one up with a chopstick, it goes squeak, right, because of the pressure. You dip it in the very cold soy sauce, temperature change, squeak, and squeak. I did not eat the Three Squeaks. I would never eat the Three Squeaks. However, I watched in absolute horror as my coworkers ate the Three Squeaks, and then they ate the Six Squeaks and on. They just kept eating these things, and I think they primarily did it to gross me out. But I suggest that if you really want to step it up, if you really want to go, and when your friends, if you travel a lot, you'll meet friends who will always say, "Oh, what's the grossest food you've ever eaten?" I always win with the Three Squeaks. So go to China, you'll try it. Thank you very much.
Your next storyteller, he's been on the show a couple times. He's a really, really funny stand-up comedian. He runs a weekly show called Too Much Fun, which is actually after this show at the Rockaway Tavern. So if you are the type to stay out late and you want to go see a comedy show, you should come to that. It's at 21st and Stout, right by Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. If you know where that is, tie it into the benefit, you'll find Rockaway Tavern. It all comes together. It's all synchronicity tonight. Please welcome Nathan Lund.
All right, Andrew Orbital. Yeah, why not? I like to sit down here at the narrators, take a break from all that I do, talk about food. Andrew asked me to talk about food, and I was like, why me? And then I was like, oh yeah, I'm 240 pounds. Maybe that has something to do with it. And it's, you know what's really gross is when I first moved here. I lived here in Denver for 3 years now, and I moved here from Las Vegas. And Las Vegas is really gross. So I could fit in and eat way more. So So I, when I moved here to Denver, I had had a girlfriend for a couple of years, and that makes it easier, too, because she kind of has to stay with you for a little bit, you know? You have to allow for at least a little bit of growth, physical growth, before you get sickened, because it's gradual, and you've built a foundation of love and trust. But, So I enjoyed myself in Vegas, you know, amongst fat, huge people in Las Vegas, just gigantic, you know, because it is true. You can eat, you can get steak and eggs and, you know, free pie buffet, you know, and it's like $10 and everybody knows where to go. So everybody can do that, and many people do, you know, you could do that here, but people choose not to. In Las Vegas, not as many rules apply. So what I'm saying is I moved here and weighed 295 pounds. Now that's big. That's most of you in this little room added up. But like I said, in Vegas, it didn't, you know, I was like the 80,000th fattest person in Las Vegas, you know. I didn't even make a, you know, blip on the radar. I moved up here 3 years ago and I was seventh. I was the seventh most gigantic person in Denver as soon as I got here. And I was terrified. And not long after I moved here with my girlfriend, I found out that she had been cheating on me. So I broke up with her and then had to start doing leg lifts immediately and push-ups. And so now I'm what I like to call funny fat as opposed to gross fat. I can take my shirt off in a bar, and I do. And when I do, people go, "Hey, look at that fat guy," and they laugh instead of going, "Holy shit, check out that fat piece of shit," and then like get disgusted. So I'm funny fat, and it's fine. Especially living in America. I mean, you guys have seen some of these people, right? I mean, you can get so big and not even die. Like, how do these people not die? Like, right away, as soon as they hit 4,000 pounds, how do they not just explode right then? Because I have tested the limits of consumption. Believe me, I've stretched my body to the breaking point. I mean, not over time, but in any one night, I mean, come on. The calories alone, if I had health insurance, I'd probably know that I have diabetes and heart disease. Thank God I'm broke as shit. I can't go to the doctor on my salary, so I don't have to worry about those things. I feel like... I feel like food, I mean, here in America, obviously, it's almost a competition. And I feel like it is in certain families, and then it stays with you. Because when I was a kid, I have a brother and a sister. My sister's here tonight. She's beautiful. And contrary to what she looks like, it felt like there was a competition amongst us kids to be able to eat the most. And it wasn't like a friendly, hey, I bet I can have more mashed potatoes than you. It was more like, if there is more to be eaten, I'm going to eat it because I don't want you to eat it. You know, like a very, and I mean, that's unhealthy, obviously, but, and it wasn't like fostered. My parents didn't like not make enough for us sometimes. It wasn't like that. It was more like a really, if there was anything left, I'm going to get it. And that turned into like eating faster than everybody else. And we were competing with our dad, who was a big guy and an adult. So we had some stiff competition. And we had to like really power it down in order to get more, and it really turns into, and if you think about like now that we're adults, you know, think about how we ate as kids and how our parents perceived a nice dinner. It was 8,000 calories a person. It was, you know, two starches and red meat and five glasses of milk to power it down, and then maybe some green beans that you maybe ate. You know, and that was an American dinner. You know, and the fried chicken, why not, with mashed potatoes and gravy? You know, because you've got some broccoli on there, so it's going to be fine. No, it's not. And to eat, have more. And then that was like a decent, like middle of the road, Midwestern. We lived in Illinois, so a Midwestern fat family. It's gotten worse and worse since then. It's not even that anymore. It's, hey, kids, pile into the minivan because we're going to get McDonald's at 11:30 at night. Like, it's gotten worse for people. Like, that's why they've gotten, like, I was a chubby kid, but I would look healthy. You would think I could do pull-ups and climb the rope in gym compared to some of the kids. They're the size of these kids now. It's really, it's way worse. And it's McDonald's every day and all that. And it's just terrifying to think, like, to just know the barometer can be, you know, way higher for people who, like, if your parents are both 400 pounds your whole life, you're not going to sweat. Well, you're going to sweat, but you're not going to worry about hitting 250, you know? You're healthy compared to the people around you. And thank God I didn't have that around me. My mom is tiny like my sister, and my dad is big, and I was big, and that was it. And so but I continued that trend of just being able to eat as much as I wanted, you know, and get seconds. I mean, once you don't have your parents to tell you to knock it off, you get into high school, you can drive. You know, there's Del Taco's on every corner if you look hard enough. And God, so you can really let loose in America. You know, you can eat whenever you want, wherever you want, and really just pound it home. And so, luckily, I always had I had friends around me from a young age, small town living where everybody grew up together. So it wasn't like a new fat kid, and I wasn't the fattest fat kid ever. There was always kids fatter than me. So I was able to, Sam Taylor, another comic, wants me to name my first CD something I told him about me growing up. I was like, well, I wasn't the fattest and I wasn't the dumbest. So I snuck by without any major, like, calamitous hazing, you know, or bullying. But it was true. I wasn't the biggest guy. So I didn't feel like I was an outcast, you know. And God bless the kids that just get mercilessly pummeled for being fat, because I know that, as Jared talked about, the dog stress eating. I mean, just being like, good or bad, you know, it's not even stress eating. It's more like heightened emotional activity eating, you know, happy or sad. You know, if you have a heightened emotion inside of you, you almost feel like the next step can be to eat. I mean, not everybody, but weird people. It can get tied in where it's like food is right there and it's a comfort thing and it's a stress relief, you know? I mean, people either smoke in America, you either smoke to alleviate stress or you eat or you work out if you're, you know, one of the 1% that work out to help resolve your stress in a healthy way. You work out like the 12 people that do that. But man, the eating and then the smoking. So you're either skinny but unhealthy, or you're huge and unhealthy. And I have always leaned towards the eating. I don't know why, like, because I can bite my nails when I want a cigarette. I guess that's my that's my substitution for that. But the eating, God, the eating. Doing stand-up comedy, you can get it caught up in the highs and the lows. You can have a good set and think, man, people think I'm funny. I'm the next fucking Hicks. And, you know, people fucking are going to remember me for what I say. And you can ride that wave, and it can... I ride the wave of a great set into the same beach as a terrible set where I hate myself. 7-Eleven. 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, 7-Eleven. I won't remember what I ate until the next morning. I have to rifle through the garbage for fucking food clues based on wrappers and what color my fingers are coated, you know, with what dust is on my fingertips. I can piece together the food mystery of the night before. It's terrible. Being a comic means late nights. It means drinking and drugs, you know, are prevalent, you know, available. You know, they're not everywhere, but they're fucking available. And then the food thing is just here. It's basically just 7-Eleven and a couple of like small little restaurants that'll stay open late. But it's the 7-Eleven where you can just eat the worst things. I mean, you know, they would have salads and they would kill you. You know, they would just be have bricks of bacon grease coated in there. And for the longest time, I would do taquitos. I would get 8 taquitos and some nachos. You know, and just, you know, stuff hot off the grill, you know, the fucking catch of the day. And the worst thing is that you're not eating 7-Eleven and then going to the gym. You're eating 7-Eleven and then going immediately to sleep. Like, the worst thing for your body to do after, when it has so much work to do, like, you have to process all this bullshit that you've just shoved down your throat. Then you just go to sleep and slow everything down for about 12 hours. And you just let everything marinate inside of your bottom. And then what would fuck me up is I would, well, not would. This is not a path. These are not anecdotes. These are journal entries from the last couple of weeks. I shouldn't make it sound like I've conquered these demons. This is an ongoing fucking... I haven't had a taquito in a couple of months because I replaced them with 7-Eleven's barbecue rib sandwiches. Which is a McRib, but without the vegetables. So it's actually worse than a McDonald's McRib. There's no pickles or onions to save you to justify... Well, you know, yeah, there was some ribs and some barbecue sauce, but there's a couple of veggies on there. These don't have the veggies at all. It's just... meat and bread, it might be meat, something, and then bread. So what I've done a lot is I will drink a lot and then eat that stuff, but I've also smoked a lot of weed. And when I smoke weed, it slows down all my body's processes. And so it basically just allows you to shove way more food into a body than it should fit because... your bodily systems aren't pushing it through. They're just kind of saying, all right, well, I guess just go over there. There's some room over there. And then you wake up the next day and you're just trash compacted down deep to where I've shit 12 times in a day, like 12 separate 30-minute staycations where you're fucking... you can ace an onion crossword in the morning. You know what I mean? And it's just so many steps where it's like you can have what feels like a full bowel movement, but you know you're nowhere close to done. You know that's a chapter in this anthology. It's such a terrible thing for your body. And you know what else is... one of my roommates, Jim, is a crazy weird food guy. Like, he'll get into weird food things. And he bought a water, magic water dispenser. It's like it ionizes the water. And so you can have alkaline water, which supposedly makes your body healthier. You can't get cancer if your body's in an alkaline state and all that other bullshit that you read about here in infomercials late at night. For the longest time, I thought, oh, well, I'll drink this alkaline water and it'll make me... it'll make me healthy. That's what I thought. I can just drink this water. I drank that water for probably 5 months, and I threw up every day. For so many months, I would just wake up completely ill, and I would throw up. And after a while, I realized it wasn't all the food that I was eating, the terrible food that I would eat late at night. It was the fact that I was eating that terrible food and drinking this alkaline water. It was just a battle, a clash of the titans, the yin and yang of health, where it was just, the alkaline water was like, seriously, dude, you've got to get this poison out of you now. Like, as soon as I'd wake up, I'd be like, the water was trying to save my life. And I'd just be like, no, just keep it in there. I'll shit it out eventually. I'm not worried about it. Just fucking leave it alone. It'll be fine. And I eventually stopped drinking the water. The fucking the McRibs won over the water. And I haven't thrown up in months. It's been a few months since I stopped drinking that water, and I haven't thrown up in so long, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, I think I should be throwing this stuff up, and the fact that it stays down, I think it means my body has given up. It's just rolled over and acknowledged that this is going to happen. Maybe someday it'll wise up like Jody's friend's mom, but until then, it's just taken the abuse, and it's gotten pretty good. It can take a punch. If you look at this body, it can take a punch. Like I said, I would really like it if you guys made it to my funeral in a couple years. That would mean a lot to me. Thank you.
All right, we're your last storyteller of the evening. Thank you all so much for sticking around. She's a very, very talented comedian. She actually created Denver's first all-female sketch comedy show called Ladyface, and the next one is December 17th, which is awesome that Denver already has a great comedy scene, but to have its own all-female sketch comedy group really puts us above everybody else, so awesome work. This is Mara Wiles, everybody.
Take that, Kansas City. You don't have your own sketch lady group. Coming after you, Des Moines. Thanks, I'm really excited. I've always wanted to do this show, and I never can because I'm super busy. But when Andrew told me the theme was food, it was tough for me because I don't really have a very complex relationship with food. I've been this size since I was about 11. I've tried to put on weight, lose weight. Nope, about this size, maybe give or take 5 pounds. I've ran 13 miles a day. I've not ran 13 miles a day. I'm eating 13,000 calories a day, pretty much this weight. Some people eat their feelings. I don't. Like those Lifetime movies where the girls vomit into Tupperware. I don't get that. I don't get not eating. That seems stupid not to eat. Why would you do that to yourself? I've never been molested by a cucumber. Pretty straightforward relationship with food. But one thing I do with food is I associate it a lot with memories. Because I have those, and I feel those. So I'm going to tell you, for me, it's like relish, the thought of relish still grosses me out, because when I was like 5, my older sister made a potion that I had to drink to get into her club that consisted of everything in our refrigerator, like everything, pickles, mustard, milk, lemonade, primary ingredient, relish. So, no thank you, hot dog. Get away from that. Late night, shitty calzones and tacos will remind me of the first boy I ever cared about and his bad eating habits. And Nutella and animal crackers will always remind me of my college roommates and how lazy we were. And how much bad television we like to watch. But my absolute favorite food in the world, my absolute favorite food in the entire world, my favorite eating experience ever, crab picking. Eating crabs. You know it. We know it. And I'm not talking Joe's Crab Shack, all you can eat king crab fucking legs that smell like the plastic they came in on. I'm talking about Chesapeake Bay blue crabs that you catch. And then you, yes, and then you boil, and then you steam them, and then you pour them out on a table with newspaper, and there's Old Bay, and there's butter, and there's vinegar, and there's too much Miller Lite, and you eat that crab. So that is what I'm going to tell you guys a little story about tonight, and it's my favorite food and my favorite one of my favorite memories from growing up. So growing up, I lived a little bit outside of D.C., like a suburb of D.C. My father had grown up, a big Irish Catholic family is a big theme tonight. My father's from a big Irish Catholic family, and they'd always go on vacation to this place called Bethany Beach, Delaware. Every year, every summer, like clockwork, mid to late August, they're getting the beach houses, we're getting the kids in the car, and we're going to the beach, and we're having a kick-ass time. And, like, my both sides of my family, like, my mom's side and my dad's side, I think we all face that dilemma, like, what side do you like more? Sorry, family, if this gets picked up and you all listen to it. Wild size wind every time. Cosgroves are cool and all. They're a little neurotic, and they fight about the stupidest shit. Whiles, they are down just to have a good time, talk about sports, and tell you how fucking funny you are. I'm in for that all the time, Uncle Terry. You want to tell me I'm a catch and I'm funny? Let's do this all night long, old man. So going on vacation with the Wiles family was something I always looked forward to every summer. And it was, we'd get into the car, and the drive was about, I don't know, I was five, so forever. Because all I wanted to do was get in the beach and wear my bathing suit from the time we got there when we picked up the rental keys to the time we left the following Saturday. And sure, it probably set some sort of weird bladder infection for the next 3 weeks, but I didn't care. That one piece with the side clipped on the side was not coming off until I said so. And the great thing about it was, too, we'd get like four, like there are six brothers and sisters, and per capita average was like 2.5 kids plus, so like 20 grandkids, 12 aunts and uncles, grandparents, weird periphery friends that for somehow, like if you are familiar with how East Coast people work, they don't get rid of anyone, and they just invite them on vacation for years and years. Like there's this guy named Jack Cullen that's like pretended to be in my family for like 25 years. And he's always like, hey, what's up, what's up? Ooh, hey. It's like, Cullen, you're not in our family. You're never going to be in our family. Go talk to your wife that doesn't like you very much. So we go to the beach every year. And I remember this summer particularly because things were going well. The suit was looking great. My Aunt Mary had just bought me and my cousin Carrie and Kelsey, who are right around my age, dolls, like stuffed plush dolls. It was really right when pound puppies were big, but they had done other versions of pound puppies. So there's like a sheep and a zebra. And I got the sheep because I was timid. But then so it was a great day. I got some great swag from the boardwalk. Had laid out in the sun all day long. And at this time, like my parents, my mom had me when she was 30. So she's probably like 35, 36. So still pretty cool. Like, remember when your parents were cool and, like, in their 30s and they loved just drinking with their, like, they all got along, all the aunts and uncles got along, all the brothers and sisters got along? Basically, they just get Miller Lite and Budweiser and just call it a day. And at the beach, you could just wake up, drink, eat, drink, eat some more, and drink. So in this particular time at the beach, this day we'd come home, we'd always try to get crabs. And in the summer, growing up by the bay in Maryland, you ate a lot of crabs just because that's what you do. It's how you get together. You eat crabs a lot, and then you get them from water people. So there's a difference. So there's normal people who enjoy eating crab, and then there are those who dungeonously find these crabs and serve them to you on a platter. And those are water people. Watch out for them, especially in alleys late at night. So it's always a big deal because we do this big night where we'd get tons of crabs. And if you're familiar, crabs are not, like, super cheap. I mean, hermit crabs, sure, you can get a million of those. But blue crab, $20 a pound. I don't know. Again, five. Prices don't make sense. So this particular night was our big crab-eating night. We got a bunch of crab. And, again, there's, like, a million of us. Jack Cullen's at the end of the table. Calls on a stir. Aunts and uncles, kids are all under probably the age of 12. My cool cousin Megan's sneaking booze. Like, everyone's having a great time. You know, they do the ritual of steaming all the crabs. And at this particular night, we're at my Uncle Tommy's rental, the youngest of all the children, Uncle Tommy. Big success in Wall Street, no big deal. But it was at his house. Got all the tables together, big row table, poured out the crabs. And when you do it, you just put down newspaper to not make a mess. Because this is the cleanly experience. Put down a newspaper on the table. You steam all your crabs that you've got. And you just pour them out. They've been seasoned. It's all over the place. There's just big things of butter in the middle of the table. And then corn and hush puppies. Again, the Budweiser and Miller Lite place. Juice boxes for the ladies. So you just start eating. And it's like a free-for-all. And it's a coming-of-age thing for anyone that grew up in this kind of culture of where this is what you do, is how to learn how to pick your own crab. Because there's a long time where your little hands can't do it and you're scared or whatever. It's got claws. Oh, no. Fuck up. Grow up, okay? What you do is you take a knife and then you stab that thing and you rip open its rib cage. Oh yeah, that's just the start of it. Once you rip open its rib cage, you basically punch it in the ribs to break its ribs to make it easy to get their meat out, their sweet, sweet meat. If you don't want to eat, and I would always eat the gross stuff, like the organs and stuff, like that didn't bother me. There's like a green, how many in here has actually eaten a Chesapeake Bay crab? You feel me? That's a lot. Good job, guys. Those of you who hasn't, there's like a, I like to call it a flavor mustard, but it's their guts. Some people shy away from it. I just dive right in. So you're cracking it, you get in the claws, you're breaking those open, you're just, and it's more of the ritual. Like, it's not that this is like a fulfilling meal. It's like, oh, that really hit the spot. Like, and it is delicious, but it's like that whole thing of sitting at this long table, the sun is setting, there's the smell of the ocean coming at you, you're all sunburned, and your parents are young and tan, and they actually like each other on vacation. Everyone likes each other. Everyone's having a great time. Everyone's laughing and having fun and drinking and telling stories. And I really, truly believe that some of these dinners is where I picked up my sense of humor, my sense of friendship, and my sense of, like, learning how to entertain and have a good time. You sit down, have a meal with people you love, have fun with it. So we eat, and we eat the crabs. I'm cracking on my own. My baby sister can't handle a single claw like an idiot. Don't want to go up to the table with any cuts or sores, and if you do have those, please leave our table, because you're going to complain about the vinegar. So this particular night, everyone's having a great time. We're having so much fun. And it's one of those times where, like, the kids are all still, like, it's on vacation. Everyone's cute and fun. Like, you know, you guys, show them that thing. Show them that thing you showed me. Show me that thing. Show me that thing. So I was showing my thing. Everyone's drinking too much and having way too good of a time. Me and my cousin Carrie, who's about this tall when we were six, we're doing a knockoff rendition of Little Bunny Foo Foo, which apparently drives drunk adults nuts. So we're singing Little Bunny Foo Foo, I don't want to see you running through, I'm picking up field mice and bobbing them on the head. Just slaying the crowd. Uncle Terry's loving it. Uncle Jimmy, you can't stop laughing. Aunt Annie, pull yourself together. Things are getting loud. It's getting late. Like, we're five. We should not be up. It's, what, midnight? Oh, my God. We're crazy. And then all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. Jack Cullen, sit down. There's a knock at the door. My Uncle Tommy stands up. It's his house. He answers the door. Pull it together, Tommy. Goes to the door. Bethany Beach, PD. Shutting down our good time. Comes in, basically Tommy has to take the truck. I'm pretty sure my father came up with him too, Charlie. If you guys don't know him, that's fine. You'll meet him someday. Came up too, but I'm pretty sure when he saw the cops, my dad did it all. Not my rental house. And bowed out. So Tommy's handling the police, and it's a noise violation. Apparently it was so bad or something. I don't know all the details, but it's a noise violation. He has to just go down to the police station. And my cousin Carrie is sobbing. She thinks her dad is going away for hard time. Serious hard time. He's going to be pulling taffy for years on the boardwalk. And I'm like, Carrie, don't worry. I'll do my Urkel impression and get this party back to neutral. Didn't work. Just got things crazier. Uncle Tommy's in a state pen. No, I'm kidding. But he leaves, and it's kind of just one of those stories that, like, the next day it's like, oh, Tommy went down for a little Bonnie foo-foo party that got a little out of control. But that's just one of my favorite things I ever think of the beach, because the beach was really one of my favorite things growing up. Still to this day, if I could just live on a beach and just, like, eat crabs every single day, I would, in a heartbeat, for sure. No questions asked. Tell me to do it tomorrow, I'll leave you guys. I don't even care about any of you. But I think what I like most about food and meals, well, living, and sleeping and pooping, those are probably three of the things I like best about eating. So fourth thing I like about meals is this ability, like, I'm grown up now, and I don't get to go to the beach every summer anymore. I don't get to see my family, the Wildses, the fun ones. Those goddamn Cosgroves keeps coming back for more. But I don't get to see the Wildses as much as I would like. And it bums me out, but it also makes me really happy that I have all these really great memories from growing up and going and, like, learning how to body surf. For some reason, buying a lot of porcelain figurines when I was at the beach, like, every summer. Learning how to pick crabs. Learning how to have fun on vacation and not do anything. Note to everyone in this room, if you're those people who go on vacation and do a lot of stuff, you're not going on vacation. Just go rent a house and forget about life. And that's what you do at the beach. And you get some sort of UTI sometimes if you're four. But that's the thing I remember most about picking crabs. And, like, I've told this to many friends. My meal at my wedding will be crabs. I'm going to have Chesapeake Bay steamed crabs. I don't know how I'm going to afford it with my shoestring budget. So not all of us are crazy Kim Kardashian, but we try. But the thing I will have at my wedding is crabs. Everybody, maybe just me and my husband will have them, and we'll just eat them at you guys. But I want, like, that memory that I've had and forever I will always have, and I want my children to have that. I want my children to remember me tan and young and fun and making them do stupid shit on top of a table while strangers and family drunkenly shout, "Do that! Do it louder! Do it again!" And I also want my kids to remember me as that person who does all that stuff for them, brings them to the beach, and makes these memories with their cousins and their families. And also see me really, really drunk someday. And maybe go to jail. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Andrew.
So that was the November narrator show. The narrator's minicast will be out in a few weeks. And then we'll be back with the December show, the theme of which is pride. Thanks for listening.